He spent 2 years from 2005 to 2007 in China as a Peace Corps volunteer teaching at a university in the heartland. This is not the urban China that we hear about with its gleaming new skyscrapers, superhighways, high-speed rail, high-tech factories, and growing middle and upper classes. Rural China is poor by comparison, traditional, communist, and home to a billion people. Levy writes about teaching and living in Guizhou province in his insightful and funny book called Kosher Chinese. He was the first Jewish person his students and fellow professors had ever met, and they gave him the nickname Friendship Jew. He taught English, gave romantic advice, played basketball, ate unusual and in some cases unsettling food, and made friends. He's been back each summer since, and he joins us on Radio Times. And Michael Levy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Why did you want to go to China as a Peace Corps volunteer?
Oh, boy. Well, to answer that question, we actually have to go back to Israel. I was living in Jerusalem, studying in a yeshiva in 2000, and left the country as the second intifada began. And I left not because my experience wasn't going well, but I left because I was afraid of terrorism. And I moved on September 1st, 2001 to New York City. So out of the frying pan and 10 days later into another frying pan. Like a lot of New Yorkers, like a lot of Americans, I was scared. I was confused. I guess I was angry, and I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what I could do. My mom would tell you that if I get a hangnail, I get woozy. So
The military was out,
but I had heard of this thing called the Peace Corps. When I thought of the Peace Corps, I thought, oh, it's John F. Kennedy, hippies. I don't know exactly what it is, but I started to do some research, and I fell in love with what I was reading. It's a very humble organization. 200,000 Americans have joined the Peace Corps in the 50 years since it began in 1961. And so I threw my hat in the ring, and they, 4 years later, sent me to China.
But when we largely think about China these days, we do think about those coastal cities and this dominant, you know, superpower that's giving us a run for their money, for our money rather, I guess their money as well.
Yeah.
This is about a different part of China that might a third world country, if it were a standalone country.
So actually, when I arrived in China in 2005, I didn't speak a word of Chinese. I didn't know much about the history. Peace Corps looked at my skills. I'm a classroom teacher, and they felt that they fit best in China, so off I go. I knew what I read in the New York Times, what I saw on CNN, and China's this booming place. And suddenly, I see nothing similar to that. And when I was writing blogs to my friends and family back home, their response was, "Where in the world are you?" Because what they saw in the news and then what they saw me writing about, they just don't come together. And the way that I describe China to my students here in America is I say, you have to imagine something just like the United States, the same number of rich and poor, there's people with BMWs, there's big cities, there's this, there's that. Take the United States, same size, and now add a billion people who survive on $2 a day. Right. So Marty, how would that affect our understanding of politics, our understanding of economics? That's China. And so I was teaching with that other billion. I was in the middle of the country. You drop your finger on a map and hit right in the middle of China. That's where I was.
But this is most of China, at least by population count.
More than a billion people, and then say 300, 400 million on the coast who genuinely are skyrocketing ahead. And Shanghai is their income level. The average income level in Shanghai is the average American.
Wow.
So Shanghai is an amazing city, but you go to the hinterland where I was, Guiyang, this city, it's $2 a day.
You describe, I guess it's getting out of the airplane and literally just coughing because the pollution was so bad. In fact, someone says, you know, you'd probably be better off smoking a cigarette than actually breathing this air.
Yeah, my first Chinese teacher, she was a pretty interesting woman, and she said, Mike, you should take up smoking because it will prepare your lungs for Chinese air. And I, you know, obviously I told her that that's not true until the Peace Corps nurse asked that the volunteers cease strenuous exercise because you breathe more deeply. Wow. And the Chinese air is devastated. It's poisonous. My eyes would water. I would cough. I had a physical reaction to being in China. And if you want to get somebody excited about the Environmental Protection Agency, send them to China for a week because it's awful.
Can you acclimate to that? Does your body acclimate to that level of smog and pollution?
Well, I did end up joining the Guizhou University basketball team, so I did get my exercise. Guizhou is a little bit removed from these booming cities, so the air is not nearly as bad. Mm-hmm. We had blue sky days almost every day. In terms of acclimating, I never acclimated. It's overwhelming. It's like living in a soup. And I couldn't get over it.
Now, you lived on $2 a day, as did the people that you were living amongst. How does one live on $2 a day?
So the Peace Corps, this is just such a wonderful organization. One of the things I've been doing is traveling around talking to students about Peace Corps, because even though it's 50 years old and we have had 200,000 people go, a lot of people don't realize it's still around. But I really encourage people to look into it. We had volunteers from 21 to 71. In our Peace Corps cohort. It's just a wonderful way to do service. And to get to your question, yeah. Peace Corps' idea is that Americans should live in a similar way to the peers that they have in their community. So I was paid about $100 a month, which was more than enough to live on. I lived in the teaching compound that other teachers lived in at Guizhou University. I learned Chinese. I celebrated the holidays. I ate all of the food, which I'm sure we'll get to.
Which we will get to, yes.
And it worked, because my peers, my colleagues, assumed a lot of the wrong things about Americans, that we are, to be honest, they said, Mike, you're not fat. I thought Americans were fat. They assumed I was Christian, which many of the few Americans who have visited Guizhou were generally missionaries. And they assumed that I was rich and arrogant, to be honest. Seeing somebody living in the community, fully immersed, and believe me, I screwed a lot of things up, but I did my best.
Yeah,
I think it really did make a difference, and that's the way Peace Corps tries to do it.
Now, you were perhaps the first Jewish person that they had ever met.
I think I probably was, yeah.
And it was a great reaction to you, because when they learned that you were Jewish, it was like, oh,
yes.
Karl Marx was Jewish too.
It was almost like it was scripted, but there are two famous Jews in China. Karl Marx is one of them, and Einstein is the other. And so when
you're in good company,
I was in good company. And whenever I would tell people I was Jewish, they would immediately say, oh, like Comrade Marx, and oh, like Einstein. So they assumed I was, I guess, brilliant and very red. and it helped break down some doors, you know, the wall that can come up between people that are coming from different cultures. But they just got such a kick out of having a Jewish guy around that it helped.
And the nickname Friendship Jew was as it's obviously a friendly moniker.
Yeah. Chinese, the stereotype is that they treat teachers with great respect, and that's absolutely true. And if you see, you know, typical Chinese meals, it's family style, you know, you're sitting around, you're sharing a lot of the food. It's a very laid back, very friendly, very open culture, but there's still the remnants of the Cold War. Where I was living, it was a traditional place, and the 50s, 60s, 70s communist inspiration was still everywhere. Propaganda posters, Chairman Mao statue in the middle of the city, a picture of Mao, Marx, Lenin, and Engels hung above me in my classroom. It was a world that seemed like it was frozen a little bit in amber. So any little way that I could just introduce myself as something other than the evil American was really helpful.
Now, you taught, I guess, conversational mm-hmm. English. Mm-hmm. I guess you had, at least initially, learned some rudimentary Chinese?
Yeah, so, and boy, I would never, ever, ever have been able to learn Chinese sitting in a classroom in America. I'm not a good language learner. But being in China, being in a place where I had to learn it in order to interact, in order to even get a bowl of noodles, I was able to learn pretty quickly. We had 10 weeks of very intense training, 6 hours a day of language learning, and then 2 years of service. And by the end,
you're pretty conversant.
I'm totally conversant. My reading and writing, I'm like an infant. You know, I'm but and actually, here's the funny thing. So the last couple summers, I've been teaching in Beijing. So I haven't been in the countryside in Guizhou. I've been in Beijing. And when I speak Chinese in Beijing, my Chinese friends look at me and they say, why do you have such a strange accent? And I tell them I learned in Western China in Guizhou, and they say, oh, well, you know, you sound like a hick. But, you know, the best I can do.
And that also sounds a bit like America.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely. Right. Well, that's one of the when I was in China, this was during the Bush years, and a lot of people were talking about red states and blue states in America. And it's the same in China. The interior is red state China. It's communist.
Conservative.
Well, it's funny how these things can get mixed up. But yeah. And then the latte sipping coast of China, where they have Starbucks and it's like globalization and capitalism. There is an even bigger divide in China than we have here in America.
You say your students had English nicknames that they had created for themselves. So I guess even this is a remote part of China, American culture infiltrates. Yes?
Oh boy! Well, do I have a story for you? Because recently I was reading China Daily, and China Daily did a survey of, I guess, teenage Chinese who had self-selected an English name, so not a name given to them by a teacher. Mm-hmm. And by the way, every student from kindergarten through college must learn English in China. So everybody knows a little bit of it. The number one self-selected name for boys in China is LeBron. Yes.
They love basketball.
They love basketball.
And
so,
they love LeBron.
And they love LeBron. So indeed, my students chose, sometimes they chose amusing names. Sometimes they I don't think they really knew what they were choosing. One of them, his nickname was God, which I thought, let him keep it. Another one named herself Larple, which she explained to me. She said, it's because I am a little chubby like a large apple, which is adorable. But of course, anytime we're learning a second language, there's the chance that we're going to do something a little bit goofy. And yeah. I made a lot of language mistakes myself, and my students made mistakes. And the great thing that I learned from them is that patience and kindness are very important when you're learning a second language.
And wasn't there a student that also had named himself Hitler?
Yes, this was one of my good buddies who taught at another school nearby called me up and he said I had a student who named himself Hitler. He forced the student to change his name, and he forced him to change his name to Moses, which was wonderful. So somewhere in Guizhou province, there is a Moses. And we asked him, we said, why did you pick the name Hitler? And he said, well, because Hitler was very strong and stood up for his people. And I asked, well, do you know any other bits of the history? And he didn't. So it was an innocent mistake.
That's interesting.
In some ways.
We're almost up on a break here. But so how much did they know, I guess bits and pieces they know about Western culture or culture outside of their own province or country?
This is one of the most interesting things to me was learning about their perceptions of the United States and of Americans. And I would say that their awareness of us is a little bit more, there's more depth to it than our awareness of them. I had never even heard of Guizhou province before I arrived there. My students, they had, I would say, a stereotypical view of Americans, but they all knew our president's name. Most Americans don't know Hu Jintao. They all knew about Vietnam War, World War II. They had learned bits and pieces, but there's definitely a gap between reality and the Chinese perception. And there's 50 years of propaganda to overcome. And the propaganda hasn't been very, very kind to the United States.
And the head of the school called himself Mr. Bill.
President Bill. His hero was Bill Clinton.
And so he called himself Mr. Bill.
Yeah, that's right.
That's Mark Levy, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the 2 years that he spent in the Peace Corps, and it's the subject of his memoir, a new book called Kosher Chinese, Living, Teaching, and Eating with China's Other Billion. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. We'll get to the food section of our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Children's Beach House and Chester County Arts Association support WHYY, announcing Plein Air Brandywine Valley, a painting and photography competition and sale. Judges include Brandywine Valley artist Frolic Weymouth and Stephen Perloff of Photo Review. Opening gala and final competition September 30th at 7 p.m. The art show and sale, as well as family activities, will be held October 1st and 2nd at the Tatnall School and is open to the public. For tickets, schedules, and more, PleinAirBrandywineValley.org.
You ask for it, we listened. WHYY-FM is trying something new. YStream, pledge-free streaming radio. Listen without membership breaks on your desktop, laptop, iPhone, or iPad. Visit WHYY.org by October 12th, make a $60 pledge, and enjoy WHYY-FM without membership breaks during our entire October fundraising campaign. For more information on YStream, WHYY's new pledge-free stream, visit WHYY.org.
Spring bulb planting time is almost here. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal when to plant your bulbs and how to protect tulips and other tasty ones from squirrels and other outdoor omnivores. Plus, the science behind green walls and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Michael Levy, who has taught both in the United States and in China. He's also got a new book. It's a memoir called Kosher Chinese, Living, Teaching, and Eating with China's Other Billion. And this is about the 2 years he spent in the Peace Corps teaching in the heartland of China, not along the coast in those bustling cities that we know about. And he joins us on Radio Times, obviously, to talk about what he learned about this part of China and to talk about food as well. And of course, that's very much a part of your title, Kosher Chinese.
Yes.
Of course, we know that on Sunday, Jews eat Chinese food, right?
Yes, and every Christmas Eve.
And every Christmas Eve, exactly.
So I am a big fan of American Chinese food, but it's not real Chinese food. Guizhou province is a particular type of Chinese food, very spicy, very oily, unbelievably delicious. And after living there for 2 years, I was actually healthier than I've ever been.
Really?
Yeah, and it's because the food is all local. You know, it's all fresh. There's no dairy. There's no sugar. And I felt fantastic at the end of these 2 years. And that's despite the fact that every meal I ate was deep fried. But it's just, it's a really spicy, pungent, fresh, wonderful food, and I miss it. I really miss it.
Well, you were kosher when you started, and you were also vegetarian.
Yes, I was coming out of years, maybe 5-6 years, where I hadn't had any meat at all. And that was, boy, you know, we are what we eat, and a lot of Americans right now are trying to figure out, you know, what's moral and what should I do? Should I go to Whole Foods? Should I go to a farmer's market, this or that? And these are important questions to ask. But when I went to China, my primary concern was being a good guest, and I really wanted to embrace the Peace Corps idea of immersing myself in as fully as I could in the community. And so, oy, for better or for worse, I decided I wasn't going to import my own cultural norms, and I decided I was going to eat whatever was served to me. And I did with maybe one or two exceptions. And luckily, my mother is off in Europe, so she can't hear this right now if we end up talking about what I did eat. But in the end, I'm glad that I made that decision, because sitting and eating is such an important part of every culture. Sharing a meal, but Marty, you might have the same problems. We all have the same problems. If you go to somebody's house and they serve you something you either don't like or don't eat if you are making certain food choices, religious restrictions, that's a tough position to be in. And I don't know what's right and wrong, but I know that in China, I wanted to say yes. And so that's what I did.
Well, I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book a couple of paragraphs here. And this is yeah, I guess, your entree to a bowl of millipedes.
Yes. Yeah, so this was shortly after I had arrived in Guiyang at the site, near the site that I was going to be teaching. I strongly believe there is no species of millipede I will ever find palatable. The particular version I found in my bowl on a warm summer evening in the summer of 2005 was an easy call. There were hundreds of them, red and pink, each about an inch long. They had however many legs it takes to make something milly, as well as angry-looking pincers from both the front and the back. They had been deep-fried and were left moist with oil. The dish included long sugar sticks that one could lick and dip into the bowl. The millipedes that stuck would get sucked off the stick in what I had been assured was a delicious combination of sweet and sour. Nevertheless, I demurred. "I cannot eat this," I told my host, a middle-aged Communist Party official in a dusty blue jacket. We were two of the dozen or so people who had gathered at the center of Unicorn Hill Village No. 3, a tiny hamlet of perhaps 30 single-story houses constructed of cinder block and wood, to celebrate my visit and the arrival of the Peace Corps. We were sitting around a low, round table on 14-inch-high plastic stools. The millipedes glistened before me in a chipped porcelain bowl. The group stared on in silence as the village leader looked from me to the millipedes, and back to me. He had a spindly frame and tanned skin that was drawn taut against his cheekbones. He looked like a Chinese Voldemort. "Eat the food," he grunted. His wife had made the millipede dish according to what my guide told me was a very special recipe of the Bui people. The Bui were a tiny, impoverished ethnic group concentrated in the mountains of central China. These were some of the very people the Peace Corps had sent me to live with, learn from, and in theory, teach. My first meal in the village, and I was off to a bad start. "You can eat this," my guide said with a nervous smile. "It tastes good." He demonstrated for me, licking his sugar stick, dipping it in the bowl, and sucking off one particularly hairy millipede. "They're sweet," he explained, crunching away happily, "and Americans like sweet things." I nodded. "That's true," I said, as I groped for a polite escape, "but I'm a little different than most Americans." This gained me perplexed looks from both my guide and my host. "I'm a Jew." Gasps, widened eyes, furrowed brows, awkward silence. I said this last sentence in Chinese, "Wo shi you tai ren." The phrase, loosely translated, meant, "I am a person who is special too."
Michael Levy, for reading from the very beginning of his memoir, a book called Kosher Chinese, Living, Teaching, and Eating with China's Other Billion, about his years in the Peace Corps in a rural part of China. So were you a good guest and eat this bowl of millipedes?
Actually, they pulled the millipedes away and served some other meat. So that was one of the... At the beginning, I just had trouble. I wasn't quite ready to fully dive into the deep end of Chinese cuisine. But soon enough, yeah, I was eating everything. And as I note in the book, the food is delicious. I never tired of it. But it's also not stuff that I normally eat, including there's a dog eating festival. Which, yeah, you're making the face that everyone makes. It's tough.
As I was reading your book yesterday, I got to that part. I had to put the book down and close it.
Okay,
I'm
a dog lover. Let's not give away if I say yes or no. But
this was a festival of the Dog Meat King, right?
Oh, well, that's
a restaurant.
That's a restaurant that was around the corner from my house, and it did have an English name written on it, but the English name was something like Happy Food or something. And then I learned my Chinese characters and noticed that the Chinese name was Dog Meat King. So that I always shooed the stray dogs away from that restaurant whenever they were like wandering around outside.
But there was a festival.
There is. There's a dog eating festival in Guizhou. You know, it's a very, very poor place. And food is food. There's a saying, some people say it's from Guangdong. It can apply to Guizhou too. But it's that the people eat everything with four legs except the table. And even the table's not safe. So I partook in just about every kind of food. The only food that I absolutely couldn't eat and that really made me depressed was turtle. I don't know why, but it just looks just like a turtle. You know, you pull the shell off. So that was the only thing that I, all the time, I just said, "Nah, no thanks. Just bring me some chicken." Yeah. I ate more pork in 27 months than the rest of my life combined. Oh my God, it's so delicious.
Pork popsicles, right?
Yeah, well, pork everything. I mean,
pork
if you can say pork in Guizhou and it just means meat. It's just the meat. If I had said, actually, I had a married couple. They were friends, Peace Corps volunteers, and they were teetotalers, so they didn't drink, which is a huge part of Chinese culture. They didn't eat meat, and they did find it difficult to integrate into the community.
You did eat dog.
I hope she doesn't podcast this.
It's in your book.
No, of course. She knows. She knows. Yes, I did. I did.
With some degree of trepidation.
It took a long time to get to that point. And when I did, at that moment, I felt both utterly depressed and utterly triumphant because I knew that was as Chinese as I was ever going to get.
Yeah. And it does taste like...
It's not very good. It tasted like liver, chicken. I mean, I don't know how to describe it. It wasn't a very pleasant experience. But it was when I was sitting with one of my absolute dearest friends. She had invited me special just to show her hospitality. She was telling me, you know, these private details about her life. And it was actually a really nice moment.
Yeah.
And it was just part of the local culture.
Not to say that you eat dog now, but
no,
you say that your 2 years living in China, you had never felt so good. I mean, you didn't have sugar.
No sugar
and
no dairy.
Do you still stick to that diet?
I wish I did.
Have you gone back to
kosher?
Oh,
no. I'm trying. I have an identity crisis, a food identity crisis right now. I think in my ideal, I would, like a lot of Americans, try to eat more morally. More local, you know, less meat. But it's tough. I live in Brooklyn. There's a lot of delicious food. So we'll see. We'll see where I end up. But I do miss the Chinese food. I miss it a lot.
And that's Michael Levy, our guest today on Radio Times. He's been a teacher both in the United States and also in China, and spent a couple of years from 2005 to 2007 in the Peace Corps in China. He taught at a university in the rural part of that country in Guizhou province, and he's written about his experiences in a book called Kosher Chinese. Any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I found there's so many interesting parts of your book, but one part that I found quite moving was your conversations with a lot of your students who seemed to be looking for a belief system. Yes, they had communism, they had Mao, but there seemed to be something, as you write about it, kind of missing in their spiritual lives.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that they would talk to me about this in particular was because they couldn't go to their parents, who had lived in a China where religion was illegal. Chairman Mao would, you know, he'd throw you in a pig shed or worse if you expressed any religious ideas. They didn't want to go to their teachers because they were worried about how that could influence their, if they wanted to join the Communist Party, their standing in the Communist Party. Where can they go? And they went to the foreigner. They went to the Jewish guy. And so I was like the rabbi of Guizhou province, but there was a very palpable spiritual emptiness. Communism, even for the most diehard communist, there's an awareness that it's not the way China really works. So that's become hollowed out.
The kind of promise of communism.
Right. When you see very, 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 very poor people, and then in the same country there's the richest people in the world, you know, the ideology is not being lived up to. So they didn't have that. They didn't have Buddhism and Taoism, which had been sort of torn out by Chairman Mao. It's not illegal to be religious in China. It's just illegal to proselytize religion. So they were very nervous about talking to anyone about it, but they could come to me. And so my office hours, there were conversations about God, about what do Americans believe, what do Jews believe, what do Christians believe. And I felt actually a lot of a heartfelt sort of sad for my students because they didn't have that spiritual side.
Well, in fact, there was, a Friday night Shabbat, right?
Yes.
You created a sort of around some of these ideas and obviously part of Jewish tradition as well.
Yeah, they were, like I say, the school that my peers, my students, they all really wanted to get a sense of that side of Western life. Obviously, in the United States, we have a lot of diversity. We have people who are very religious, we have people who aren't religious at all, but the bottom line is we can choose our path. And I've chosen in my life, I would say, a fairly spiritual, observant path, although, of course, I ate two meals a day of pork for 2.5 years. But whatever. But that
You'll
aside,
pay for that
I'll
one
pay
day.
For, oh, that's right, I'll pay. But that aside, the young people in China in particular are yearning for something, and the Chinese government is very nervous about this because they don't know what the young people are going to grab onto. And if you go into sort of the news in China now, the Communist Party is re-promoting Confucius as an attempt to fill in this 20-year gap. I don't think it's going to work, and it's a major, major fear for the leadership in China. What will our young people believe in if this materialism that we're promoting, if that doesn't work?
You know, what's so interesting to me is that you also dispensed, I guess, romantic advice or love advice, but I wonder if those two things are connected.
They are. That's a great connection to draw. Along with forbidding religion, romance was more or less forbidden, and to oversimplify things. The reason is there's only one thing you should love in China, and it's Chairman Mao. That's an oversimplification. But at Guizhou University 20 years ago, if you were holding hands with your girlfriend, you would be expelled. Now, things are changing. Certainly Beijing, Shanghai, forget about it. I mean, it's Western. People
right.
are, it's all
right.
over the billboards, all this. In Guizhou, it's more conservative. There's more confusion. And yeah, my students, they saw Titanic. And they thought, you know, Jack and Rose, you remember the movie
Titanic?
Oh, they
saw the movie?
The movie Titanic.
And they
Jack
saw
and
it?
Oh, yeah. And they were like, that's Western love. That's perfect. And I said, well, he dies in the end. And they said, oh, that's so beautiful and romantic. And so they would come to me for advice on boyfriends and girlfriends and sex. And I felt like Dan Savage. I don't know if you ever read Dan Savage. But
yeah, indeed I have.
Yeah, yeah. So these are the sorts of things that made the experience hilarious, to be honest. I never felt entirely comfortable speaking about these things, because these are I was out of my element, but I did listen, and I just tried to be an empathetic ear.
And did the one child policy, did they, is that something they talked about?
Interesting question. The one child policy is a lot more complicated than we know, because there are layers of it. If you are living in a city, it's pretty strictly enforced. However, it's changing. If you are now a child, a single child, and you marry a single child, you're going to be able to have more than one kid. But I wasn't in the big cities. I was in the countryside, where ethnic minorities were more than half of the population of the province, and they are not subject to the one-child policy. So I had students who had more than one kid. Yeah, it's a very complicated, yeah. It's not as simple as one child for everyone.
Do they have a lot of kids or just more than one?
A lot of the families have a lot of kids, yeah, in rural China. But here's what's the most interesting thing to me. I would ask my students about the policy, and they would express a lot of, they didn't really know what the law was, but at the same time, they supported it. They said, we have too many people, and if you were in a country of 1.5 billion people and not enough jobs, you wouldn't want to have people to have a lot of kids too. I very rarely met a Chinese person who had anything negative to say about the one-child policy.
You described this as a country, and obviously a complicated country, capitalism with Chinese characteristics, which, you know, it's hard to reconcile communism and capitalism.
Yeah.
I mean, they, you know, we fought a cold war over this ideology,
well,
and yet here's a country where they seem to coexist.
Well, flip it around. We have public schools. That's an element you could say of socialism. We have public libraries. We have a mail system that's subsidized. Now, on the extreme, there are some people who want to get rid of all of that. But the average American is pretty flexible, and they want what works. They don't care what title you put on it. China, after Deng Xiaoping, became more pragmatic in that way, too. And they have elements of both socialism and capitalism. And on the extreme edges, it just gets more extreme than we have. They have rampant free markets in some parts of the country. No regulation. It's Milton Friedman's dream, right? And then on the other side, they have really pretty strictly functioning authoritarian communism in the old school way. They have both.
Yeah. And would the members of the Communist Party tell you what to teach or watch you teach your classroom? Were you in any way hampered by their presence? Or?
I was observed, but I was never hampered. It was a very quiet, subtle presence. The only advice I was given before I started teaching was to avoid mentioning the three T's: Tiananmen Square, which the 1989 massacre, Tibet, which is obviously controversial, the Dalai Lama, and Taiwan, Taiwan and mainland China have this battle. And actually, of the three of them, Tibet, Chinese people are like, who cares? We've won that battle. You Westerners, stop moaning. Tiananmen Square, ancient news. It's like an American worrying about Kent State Massacre, which my students don't even know about. The one that was really intense was Taiwan.
Oh.
That is an absolute sparking issue. And my students would get really, really upset if I mentioned Taiwan in the wrong way.
And upset, I mean, in any way show support for Taiwan, something like that?
If any even half breath that Taiwan is its own country or deserves independence, totally intolerable. And what my students, the part of American history they most enjoyed learning about was our Civil War. Because in our Civil War, Abraham Lincoln refused to let part of the country leave. And we now, at least me, most people I know, are like, good, he held the country together. So my Chinese friends would say, look, you guys love Lincoln. Well, we should take Taiwan back.
Fascinating. Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And Michael Levy is our guest. We are talking about the couple of years that he spent in the Peace Corps in China, teaching at a rural university. He has been back each summer since, and this was from 2005 to 2007. And it's the subject of his new book, and it's called Kosher Chinese.
People's Light and Theater supports WHYY and presents the return of Don Quixote, now through October 16th. Don Quixote is shaken from his boring yet respectable retirement when his old companion Sancho Panza shows up with an unauthorized biography that makes a mockery of their past escapades. What else can the friends do but hit the road again? A charming tale to remind us that romance and adventure hide around every corner, if we are brave enough to look. For information, 610-644-3500 or peopleslight.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Franzen talks about his latest novel, Freedom, which has just been published in paperback. It's in part about parenting and the kind of parents who want to be best friends with their children.
As we're talking, I'm realizing the extent to which the book is a lament for the loss of a distinction between children and grown-ups.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. This week, a heckler called President Obama the Antichrist. Rick Perry's new ad hints at end times. We'll look at the politics of the apocalypse. Also, jazz star Pat Metheny plays the Carpenters. You want to make something of it? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Michael Levy. He says China is a lot like the United States until you add the 1 billion peasants who live in largely the rural parts of the country. Levy spent 2 years teaching and living in a poor part of China's heartland. And this is a part of this country that foreigners and probably a lot of journalists never see. It's more like a third world than the global powerhouse that we associate with China. He was in the Peace Corps at the time, and he's written about his experiences in a book called Kosher Chinese, Living, Teaching, and Eating with China. His other billion. And Michael Levy has taught at in schools here in the United States and over in China as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. There's a Pizza Hut in Guiyang.
Yes.
This is the city.
That's the city I was in, yeah.
In the province. There's also a Walmart, and there's a great juxtaposition between Walmart and Mao Zedong.
So the People's Park at the center of Guiyang, the city, it's a city of about 2 million people. So in China, that's nothing. People don't even know about it. But that's, you know, for America, it's a major city. There's the People's Park in the middle. And on one end of the People's Park is a 40-foot-tall statue of Chairman Mao with his outstretched hand. And the hand seems to be gesturing to the Walmart, which is submerged beneath the People's Park. And the entrance is like this Louvre pyramid kind of thing with an escalator and the little yellow smiley face. So wow. Chairman Mao waves at the smiley face, which is about at groin level for the chairman because his statue is so high. It was a very strange juxtaposition and very typical of this really rapidly changing world that in urban China we're seeing.
And was Walmart a popular place to, or is Walmart a popular place to shop?
Absolutely. Frighteningly, Walmart was able to undercut even, you know, the farmers from the countryside. It was unbelievable. Their prices are low worldwide. Also, there's the cachet of the Western attached to it. So Americans, sometimes they don't want to shop at Walmart because, oh, it's all, you know, foreign made. In China, it's the opposite. It's, oh, it's this Western thing. So you walk around with your Walmart bag, and it adds a little bit of a little spark to what you've got, whatever's in the bag.
And I guess since everything is made in China, it's all
local. I had no moral problems with shopping at Walmart in China. That's where I got my on the rare occasion that I wanted a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, that's where I would have to go get my peanut butter and jelly.
And how was the Pizza Hut?
Would it compare? It was okay. I mean, you know, it's somewhat similar, but they reduced the amount of cheese because most Chinese can't process the cheese. And to be honest, I couldn't go because it was Western prices. So I had a little jar and I would fill it, and about once a month I would go and get French fries at KFC. And because I just needed my French fries. But it was just far too expensive for me to ever go and get Western food.
And here you are, a Jew in China, and you're playing Santa Claus at the Walmart.
Yeah, that was the most bizarre night of my entire experience. A local Communist Party official asked me to play Santa Claus, and I explained to him that I might not be the best candidate since I've never celebrated Christmas, but I guess I was the best option he had. And I ended up in a Santa suit, so in this Walmart underground, with Mao running around yelling at buy more stuff, and it was actually a terrifying experience because they chased me, a mob of shoppers chased me through the aisles. And at the end of it, I had a really nice experience talking to some of the people about their perceptions of Christmas and spirituality and those sorts of things. But it was a strange night.
Were you a fat Santa Claus or a thin Santa Claus?
I was the thin Santa Claus, but it's okay. Was the skin tone was correct. That's as far as they needed me to go.
You've taught at some interesting schools. I mean, not just this university in this rural part of China, but you've also taught, I guess, the elite of Beijing.
Well, so boy, I've been teaching for about 15 years now, and I've had the whole sort of gamut of things, from the poorest kids in rural China to wealthy elites in Beijing, but also here in the States. I taught, when I returned from China, I taught at St. Paul's School, this elite boarding school up in New England. So I've taught this huge variety, and it has led me to have some new reflections on what we're going through in our education system here in America. And I have two thoughts, and on the one hand, I think we're actually doing a very good job. The panic button that we're hitting, it's a little bit too much. You take the average school in America, it is globally competitive. It absolutely is.
See, that's a revelation, I think. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
You know what? I think that the panic that we're hearing is being generated for a particular purpose, and that particular purpose is that if people are scared enough, they're going to grab onto anything, and the anything we're grabbing onto is the profit motive in public schools. And I think that's something we should really be careful with.
Well, let me just ask you a couple of questions. So you're comparing the typical public school in the United States and perhaps the schools that you saw in China?
The wealthy in China want their children to come to school in the United States.
But they probably want them to go to St. Paul's, right?
Well, what they want to get them out of is a high-stakes system. The Chinese education system is based entirely on high-stakes testing. It's No Child Left Behind on steroids. So you take a test to get into high school, a test to get into college, a test to get into one test, one score. That's it. So we use the word accountability in our current reform movement, and I get nervous about that because I saw the consequence in China of an extreme commitment to this number instead of the human element of teaching. And here's what it is. It's a school system that deadens creativity, that does not have time for creative thinking, let alone mental or physical health. It is a miserable, miserable experience going through Chinese schools.
And you see students suffering as a result of that?
It's horrific, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, and what's interesting is that while we, thanks to No Child Left Behind, are moving more and more towards these high-stakes tests, China is recognizing the problems, and they want to import. This is why they bring the Peace Corps in, actually, because they recognize that they're not teaching creativity. They're not teaching 21st century skills, which are not rote memorization.
So your students, and these were university students, mm-hmm. So one can assume they were probably pretty good students, pretty
well. Guizhou University was not high ranked in China. My students could easily memorize anything I threw at them. No problems with that. The Chinese school system does a fantastic right. job, and therefore mathematics and languages are they do a pretty good job. But critical thinking skills were non-existent.
Really?
Yeah, and it was explicitly part of Peace Corps' job to help engender a sense of wonder and creativity and critical thinking. Because if you base everything on a bubble, it's a waste of time to think. And that's what we see in the Chinese system, and that's my fear for our system if we continue down the No Child Left Behind path. I just think it's going to be a disaster.
Well, I know you taught conversational English, but you also taught, I guess, modern...
Yeah, postmodern literature. I was lucky. My second year, I guess they liked what I was doing, and so they gave me a grad student class, and it was mostly young women. They were unbelievable, and their ability to be self-reflective... It was really inspiring. Teaching is fantastic. I love the job. And that was probably the highlight of my teaching in China was reading American poetry with young Chinese women and seeing what they would think about it. It was really fun.
The kind of poetry that might be taught in a school here?
Well, one of their favorites was Allen Ginsberg's America. That's not an easy poem.
No, it isn't.
But they were drawn into the cadence, the language, and China has a millennia tradition of writing poetry. Right. Chairman Mao himself was a poet. So I think it really appealed to their artistic side and to the side that they don't often get to express in their schools.
So what once they graduate from a university like this in this part of China, what is their life? I mean, what are the options?
Well, the options are limited. China has very strict internal migration laws. So in the United States, you know, I'm from Philly, but I'm living in Brooklyn now. I just go to Brooklyn and get a job. In China, you are limited to your local area. And if you want to go somewhere else and find a job, it's very difficult. You need what's called a hukou, and you can't really get it if you're from Guizhou province. So my students, if they want to go to Beijing or Shanghai, they're essentially going to be illegal. Within their own country. It's the equivalent of say, someone from Mexico doing farm work in California. You know, you can get there, but you can't send your kid to school. You can't get health care. And there's hundreds of millions of people in this internal and illegal undocumented migration in China. Chinese people aren't as critical of this as we might think, because they don't want massive slums at the corner of every single East Coast city that they have. But when we're examining China, we have to remember this, because this billion people that I was teaching, that's their daily reality.
Right. So if they move to the more urban areas, they are essentially illegals. If they stay where they are,
no, they're fine. If they stay in Guizhou province, they're...
Are there jobs?
There are low-paying jobs. I'll tell you, this is one of the most interesting things that happened to me as I reflected on my experience in China. I no longer criticize sweatshops. Yeah. It's a strange thing to say. My students yearned for the jobs that, before going to China, I would have condemned unequivocally. And now I am very confused, because working in a factory for $3 a day is better than working in a rice paddy for $1 a day. I'm not an economist. I don't have these profound ultimate conclusions. I just know that the kids that I taught showed me things that I never thought these words would come out of my mouth. But it's really complicated.
But that's probably what they're doing, which is working in a sweatshop making a couple bucks a day.
If they're lucky. And if they're not lucky, my students, since they were English majors, a lot of them would end up going further out into the countryside and teaching little kids. Oh. Which is, that's a cool job, but it's rough conditions. So a lot of my students right now are teaching English.
Let me get, looks like Janet from Paoli to join our conversation. And Janet, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
I
was in Taiwan in the 80s and as an exchange student, and I ended up teaching English as a second language to a lot of Chinese. And they would talk to me about Chinese astrology. They'd say, what are you? You know, meaning which animal, you know, which part of the astrology kingdom are you? Did your students know about that?
Yeah.
Thanks, Janet.
Yeah, Janet, that's great. Yes, in fact, I had a lot of students who were very much into traditional Chinese medicine, into astrology, and before I was allowed to join the university basketball team, the coach took me to get my astrology read, and he took me to this tiny little old woman in this way back a beyond village, and she asked my birthday. I don't know what she was doing. She had some sort of chart. I'm a dragon. And in the end, she said, absolutely, you're going to be a big success. So, yeah, Guizhou province, traditional place. They were very much into astrology.
Janet, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Were you a basketball player before you went to China?
I was. I went to Penn Charter, a local school here in Philly, and played basketball there. I am certainly not the most talented basketball player. But
not like LeBron,
I'm
right?
Not like LeBron, but at 6 feet tall, I was pretty big. For our province, and we were able to dominate basically in this little league that we had. It was so much fun. But more than the competition, what I enjoyed was just getting to know a group of guys, and really, you know, we would sit around, we would drink beer. Sports is an international language, and it was just such a great way to really see what my teammates were thinking about and doing, and it led to, I think, some of the most enjoyable experiences I had.
This year is the 50th anniversary of the Peace Corps.
Yes, indeed.
And I also see that in early September, a Republican congressman, Mike Kaufman, has introduced some legislation. I'm not sure what's going to happen to it.
It's just a letter. It's an open letter. And the letter criticizes the Peace Corps China program as basically a subsidy for the Communist Party. So Kaufman wrote a letter to his colleagues and asked that Peace Corps China be defunded.
And it costs something like $2.9 million, I guess, a year.
Yep.
to send Peace Corps volunteers to China.
Yes.
And he wants that eliminated.
So here's the interesting part of what he's asking us to do, and I think this part's worthwhile. We need to reflect on our spending priorities. So your money, my money, our tax dollars, $2.9 million went to support the Peace Corps program in China. is that worth doing? Well, I, of course, think absolutely. I think that it is one of the most effective pieces of our foreign policy. And in fact, diplomats around the world have made comments that are similar to that. I taught about 200 young Chinese people. They're going to go out into villages and teach hundreds more. And these are people who would never have met an American unless it was through the Peace Corps. Instead, what they'd see is propaganda. Thousands and thousands of people are going to have that little bit of experience paid forward. 2.9 million, is it worth it? Well, we can look at the $60 billion that's been, you know, waste and fraud in the war in Iraq, and we can compare that. I think Representative Kaufman is expressing a cynicism that is just, it's really disappointing.
You're going to be going back to China?
Absolutely.
I mean, this is your life, to spend your summers in China?
That's my goal. In fact, I would really love to go back full time and, you know, really live there, really get my language skills down, do some more teaching. But for now, Brooklyn's a pretty nice place to be. And one thing I do know, wherever it is I'll always be in a classroom because I really do love teaching.
And you teach at a school in New York now.
Yep, I'm in Brooklyn. It's a wonderful sort of progressive little school. We don't grade. That's right. It's K through 12. I teach 4th, 10th, and 12th grade history. And
4th, 10th, and 12th. Wow.
So St. Anne's School in Brooklyn Heights, wonderful place, but they have some very unique educational theories. And so, yep, there's no division between 4th and 12th. We don't grade. We try not to punish. It's really...
Where was the school when I was going
well,
to school?
No, but Marty, here's what's interesting. It's the exact opposite of China. So in China, it's 200 kids in a class facing forward, memorizing what the person on the dais speaks to them so they can fill in a bubble. Here, it's small classrooms. You take the curiosity of the kids and you try and just light a fire. And, you know, we have the resources at St. Anne's to be able to do that. They don't have the resources to be able to do that in China.
Well, on that note, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Michael Levy, for joining us today on Radio Times, talking about his experiences in China, where he was in the Peace Corps. And he's got a book called Kosher Chinese, Living, Teaching, and Eating with China's Other Billion. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can check us out online. You can also follow us on Twitter, and you can see what our guest looks like if you go to our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.